Morning on this beautiful, sunny, windy, rainy, stormy day. Okay, the Senate Interim Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy is in order, and we have a relatively short agenda today. First on the agenda is an update on the Senior and People with Disabilities SVDP department. Unfortunately, James Taves is not going to be with us today because James is meeting with the Brain Trust, the new governor, and a group to try to figure out where we're going to go next session. It looks like, though, we're going to be able to finish the biennium in pretty good shape, relatively speaking. With that, we will. Kathy Cooper, would you please come up and make us feel better?
Good morning, Senator Morris.
Good morning, Kathy.
The committee. My name is Kathy Cooper. I'm the Deputy Assistant Director for Senior and People with Disabilities within the Department of Human Services. And I was asked this morning to come and give you a brief update on a grant that seniors and people with disabilities received back in late 2007. In Oregon, it is called Oregon's On the Move Project. In the federal terms, it's called Money Follows the Person. It was a federal grant that came out of the Federal Deficit Act back in 2005, and it was an effort on the federal government's part to try to get states to start building home and community-based systems, much like the state of Oregon. Because as we look across the nation, Oregon leads the nation in home and community-based services. And so this effort was to try to do enhanced federal revenue and dollars to be able to move people from nursing facilities and other institutions back into home and community-based services. Oregon applied for the grant back in 2007. We've had about 265 clients that have benefited from the program. We've expended approximately $20 million, and of the $20 million, we have received $15 million in federal funds to support that program since 2008. As you are aware, I believe at the last time we testified, we have temporarily suspended the program as of September 1st. Our director from the program resigned, and as you're aware, the department started a full investigation. We did want to come and give you an update on that investigation. It has been proceeding, and we have been notified by the department that we will have a final result of that investigation no later than the end of January, and at that time they will be providing us with a full and thorough report of their findings. So at this time we have about a month or less to wait to see what the outcomes from the investigation are, and then we'll proceed with the decision about reopening the program. But I did want to make sure that you are aware during this period of time while the program has been closed, we continue to do what Oregon has done for a number of years, and that is our diversion and transition program. In the same period since 2008, we have either diverted or transitioned over 3,400 clients from nursing facilities or from hospitals into home settings or into community-based settings. Since September, all of our staff have continued their focus on diversion and transition. So at this time, both providers and clients are still receiving those Medicaid services in home or community-based settings. With that, I would be glad to answer questions or anything that you'd like to ask me at this time.
There are some programs, individual cases, that are on hold right now. Is that correct?
Senator Morris said there are some individual providers that we are still working with right now to complete either construction or remodeling or to get payments to them at this time. Okay. There, to my knowledge, there are no clients that are not getting services. The clients are all being served at this time.
Okay. Are you familiar with a case in Bend, by any chance? And if you are familiar with it, and it may be confidential information. Is that right?
Senator Morris said, I'm not sure which case you're talking about.
Okay, well, I have a constituent who lives in Springfield but owns a home in Bend, and I was called because they were having trouble getting enough clients into their facility because they did go through the remodel, and they hired a full-time person to take care of the maximum number 24/7. And because they didn't have the maximum number, they were concerned that they wouldn't be able to, you know, continue with the person that they have. And there was a glitch involved, and I'm not sure if that has been resolved.
Senator Morissette, I can explain maybe a little bit of what has happened on the program. When we received the federal grant called Money Follows the Person, mm-hmm. there are housing restrictions. And by that I mean we cannot put a person in a setting unless there are four or fewer individuals in that care setting. That is unlike most of the care settings in Oregon. Our adult foster homes have five or fewer, and our residential care and our assisted living all have more than five. And so it has been a difficult task for us to find four or fewer people from an economic standpoint mm-hmm. for the provider. But they have to keep the facility full all the time to be able to make ends meet. And that is one of the things we have learned about this program over the last year and a half, that it's very difficult to try to financially make it solvent unless you're able to keep the capacity. Most of the homes that we have remodeled and developed on the Move project are specialized homes mm-hmm. for individuals with dementia, people that are very heavy bariatric care, neurological care, or individuals with traumatic brain injuries. And so it's even more difficult in a rural area to make sure those homes are completely full at all times. So I think that might be what you're referring to.
Well, I'll have to talk to you personally about that. They went ahead and remodeled their home. They have all of the equipment and everything that's needed. They lost a couple of patients, and they were concerned that the state was not, keeping them full. But it's Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions looking ahead. One, you said that the investigative report will probably be out late January, and that will deal with that piece. Is it possible, because when we start the new biennium, we'll have new members who don't know about the Money Follows the Patient program. Are there plans by the agency to actually do some kind of summary or synopsis or some kind of information so that members in this body will have some knowledge of the program? Do you know whether that's being planned by the director?
Yes, Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, yes, absolutely. We have actually prepared a report for the e-board for this week, and we are going to present a report on senior and people with disabilities, activities around diversion and transition, which includes the Money Follows the Person program.
I know, follow-up, Ms. Jarrett, I know we're doing it for e-board, but looking at this issue will probably be also discussed in future legislative sessions. So my question is whether or not you plan to have something prepared for the 2011 session.
Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, we absolutely will be glad to have a presentation and a report ready. My understanding is that we will also follow up with a report on the investigation and fully inform the legislature of the outcomes of the investigation.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I would hope that a part of that report would be some of the information that was provided this morning, particularly in talking about what the outcomes are based on the expenditure, how many people are served, where not only the service side of it, but what problems exist in implementing the Money Follows the program, so that we have a broad picture and understanding of just what is involved and what's entailed. You know, those providers like you mentioned, and why they're not able to be successful, and also it would be helpful, I think, because Oregon is unique, that it's tied to all of our systems, so that when you're talking about a program, you know, you're talking about not only the Money Follows, but why we are actually talking about the difference between the LFFs, those systems, and also the adult foster care, so that you're tying all the systems together and how they really work.
Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, we will absolutely include all of that in our report back to the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, what I was hoping to hear this morning from James and from you perhaps, and I didn't have a chance to talk. I did talk with them yesterday about where we are right now in terms of services provided for the remainder of this biennium, as well as expected shortfalls for the next biennium, and which programs are relatively safe because of the federal Medicare requirements. Now, I would imagine that the Money Follows the Person may be one of the safer programs, because we do get the federal dollars. We are using them wisely to get people out of very expensive living facilities into more affordable facilities, which is great. We do have to provide nursing home care if we accept Medicaid. So anything that we can do to facilitate, you know, smarter spending is great. So first of all, where are we for the remainder of this biennium on some of the critical programs for seniors and disabled people?
Senator Morissette, senior and people with disabilities caseload and budget continues to be in a really precarious place. Mm-hmm. As you are well aware, there were pieces of our budget that was restored in July at the special session. Those are still targeted, and the programs are still targeted for ending at the end of February. Specifically that will impact seniors and people with disabilities, we have the instrumental activities of daily living, which is a 75% cut to our in-home instrumental activities of daily living, or self-management tasks that an individual does. That is a huge, huge cut. It will affect over 10,500 of our clients in our in-home program. It will affect our in-home providers. It will affect some of our in-home providers that will lose so many hours. They will lose their health benefits and other benefits. So that one is a very big concern to us. That one will be effective on March 1. As you're fully aware, Oregon Project Independence is targeted for closure for lack of funding on March 1st also. Right now, that will affect somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 1,900 clients that receive very limited in-home services from seniors and people with disabilities in our AAAs. We also have a cut that affects people with developmental disabilities. Our case management ratio for children is going to go to 1 to 300 cases per case management on March the 1st. We also have a reduction in our targeted case management services that both our community developmental disability services and our brokerage services provide. And also our developmental disabilities family support program is slated to be eliminated on March 1. So we still have a number of very, very difficult cuts we're facing in this biennium. We also, because of rising caseload, have been trying to do other management actions that do not require either CMS approval or legislative approval. So right now, in the month of October, we have implemented some across-the-board cuts to our crisis diversion program in our developmental disabilities area, which has made it very, very difficult, and it will make it very difficult for the rest of the biennium for families that are trying to support their children in home. And we do believe we're going to find more children and adults seeking out of home placement, which in the end will cost us more as a state. We have capped our long-term diversion in-home crisis program for children, another area that's very difficult. We've delayed the development of one of our systems that makes payments to the brokerages for our support services program, and we have limited the lifespan respite program and reduced the contracts that were in the first year of this biennium. All management actions we're trying to do to control the SPD budget so that we'll be able to be in balance by the end of the biennium.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair. Now that everybody's speechless with that. Have you... this is just around the corner when this gets implemented. So what has been the dialogue as far as solution to the cuts? Meaning, have we seen nonprofits stepping up? Have we seen some of these affected individuals responding to the department with any kind of solutions to fill the gap?
Senator Morissette, Senator Toeffler, this time in our budget crisis, we have seen that many of the nonprofits that were there back in 2003 when we experienced these cuts the last time are having their own financial difficulties, and there's very little capacity in our communities right now for individuals that will receive cuts. We have been talking to our clients, we've been talking to our home care workers, trying to see if there are other alternatives. We use what's called informal supports, so we ask them to talk to family members, to friends, to neighbors. We are trying to do other transition services and doing training with our case managers this month and next month to help them help our clients that will be affected and our providers that will be affected by these cuts. And again, when this happens, we have some individuals that have other supports, so family members, friends, churches, other people come and help them out. We have other individuals that have no one that can help them in their in-home services. They end up decompensating, deteriorating, and within a matter of months, they end up in one of our long-term care 24-hour settings. With our families with developmental disabilities, we've been working with our regional crisis staff. We've also been working with family members and with our providers. They have already taken cuts back in July. We reduced their budget in July. We're reducing their budget again, and we're asking them to still continue to take care of these individuals, even though their budgets continue to be reduced.
I'm going to call on Senator DeWinders in just a moment, but just to give a heads up to Arthur Towers and Jim Carlson and Rick Bennett, I'm going to ask you to come up in just a moment and talk a little bit about the part of the question that Senator Telfer asked. How are you working with the providers?
I'll wait for the group that's coming up.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much, Kathy, and don't go too far.
Okay.
Okay. That was fair enough warning, right? You had time to think about it, right? Arthur, come on up. Rick Bennett. Jim.
Okay.
I think this is a very important part right here because, you know, we've met in the past. We've had work groups meeting. The providers have worked for a couple of years, you know, somewhat successfully. But we're into crunch time now, and you guys are the ones who need to bear the brunt of this, obviously. And it's going to be very difficult. So with that, I would like just a kind of a brief response, if possible.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. In regard to the question of kind of what's coming next, our frontline care providers for in-home care, adult foster care, and skilled nursing facilities are very concerned. We're very concerned with the way that the proposed cut is coming down, currently slated for March in in-home care. The idea that the instrumental activities of daily living would be the services that would be cut by 70%, meaning an in-home care cut for Medicaid clients by an overall hours proportion of 40% is pretty dramatic. And when they talk about the instrumental activities of daily living, what they mean is that we'll continue to pay you to feed somebody, but we won't pay you to cook the food. And what we believe is going to happen if those cuts go through is that the in-home care provider will continue to do the work but not receive compensation for it. And so we've seen an increased pressure. Our members have seen an increased pressure on the to push the client to find the informal supports, to find the family supports, to change the definitions. Well, that's a little bit too strong, but to in an effort to compress the hours, a lot of pressure to find alternate means of care. And you know, we're concerned because what this means is that, as, or among other impacts, is that as care providers fall below 80 hours per month in terms of care, then they lose their health care. About 60% of home care workers work enough hours to qualify for health care coverage. And so as the hours get reduced, you create another problem in terms of support for care providers. And in the last study that I saw that the agency produced, the Home Care Commission was the number two employer in terms of its employees receiving public assistance. And so we see this pressure on the long-term care system playing itself out in a variety of settings. And, you know, again, we've partnered with AARP, we've partnered with Oregon Healthcare Association to try to figure out ways to maintain quality of services while at the same time recognizing that we've got to protect ours as well. And so that's kind of what we see over the horizon. Hopefully that was responsive to what you're looking for.
A couple of years ago, there was you had numbers in terms of layoffs. That maybe 2 years ago, last session. Do you have numbers of vulnerable workforce jobs lost, which are low-income jobs to start with, which means more people would then be applying for services that they used to give that, so on. So,
A couple figures on the employment front, Chair Morissette. The first one is that, again, if the cuts were to go through, our understanding, my understanding is that it would be an overall 40% loss of home care hours. And, again, you're looking at about 9,000 workers in that category, 9,000 to 10,000 in there. And so, again, not everyone's going to get laid off, but a lot of people will see their hours reduced dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I would say is that this disproportionately hit rural Oregon hardest because in many rural counties, up to 6% of the workforce is involved in long-term care. And then the third piece is that with the loss of federal matching funds, we really see a big impact as well. That study the Eco Northwest did in the fall of 2000, 2008, showed about 33 jobs per $1 million of federal funds can be attributed to drawing down the match. And so I think those are the ways that it plays itself out. And then finally, I would say that this disproportionately hits working women. And that's a big deal because many of the jobs programs that are contemplated are geared towards men. And this workforce is predominantly women.
Thank you, Arthur.
For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. Thank you, Senator. It's always a pleasure to be in your hearing room and know that there's the possibility of being able to come up and testify before your committee. Just a couple of comments. First, to Senator Telfer's question related to nonprofits, and clearly they are having difficulties as well as anybody else right now. I think it's important to remember that the vast majority of caregiving that's done in this country and in Oregon is done by family and friends. 95% or better of the care is done by family and friends. And the value of that is close to $5 billion here in Oregon. Now, that's based on a study that AARP and partnership with other nonprofit organizations completed just in the past year or so. The reality is that there's a small percentage of people, both because there are no family members or because family members have other obligations or because their care needs are such that it just cannot be done by family members. They do turn, and they don't have the resources to purchase the care in the private sector and so forth. Those individuals turn to the state, and there is an obligation to assist them and provide care to them. Now, the reality is here in Oregon, we have one of the most cost-effective and efficient long-term care systems in the country, primarily because of our emphasis on home and community-based services. Many other states are also having difficulties with their budgets and so forth, and they are looking to this Oregon model as a way to continue to meet the needs of their citizens in a more cost-effective manner. Now, when you see some of the across-the-board cuts that we've experienced over the past year, those cuts are moving us in the wrong direction. We're basically at a point where we could very well be dismantling the Oregon model for long-term care. And certainly that is a great concern to us, and I'm sure it is to you as well. I think we have to understand, and certainly AARP representing our members and all of those who are 50 and older, that yes, we do have an aging population. We do have limited resources, but we frankly should be investing in this model that we have here in Oregon because, in fact, it is one of the best ways for us to meet that growing need in the future.
Okay, thank you. Jim Carlson, we worked very hard to put some money that was recaptured a couple sessions ago into increasing the reimbursement rate for assisted living residential care rather than the nursing homes. Now, where do you see us going? What's your take on this?
Sure. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Carlson, President of the Oregon Healthcare Association. You know, at a big picture level, I think you got to understand that the Medicaid system is an important critical part of the long-term care system, but you also have to understand that you've got private resources, family caregivers, Medicare, other revenue streams that are involved too. And so what Medicaid does doesn't impact just those clients, the most vulnerable, who rely upon Medicaid services and supports. It impacts the entire delivery system, and when we're into a situation like this, it can have a pretty dramatic impact so that you're not only impacting just Medicaid clients, you're impacting Medicare beneficiaries. The decisions you make are impacting people who are private pay resources. So, for example, you talk on the assisted living rates. We'd gotten to a situation where our Medicaid reimbursement rates were so low in the assisted living residential care sectors that essentially people were withdrawing from the program. Medicaid clients were having access issues, and some cases where we had some folks withdraw completely, we had relocations and other things occurring. But what you also had for private, you reached a situation where people who with private resources, they were paying so much more. Their costs on the cost shifting that was occurring out there because of the low Medicaid, it was driving their costs higher. You get into a situation where you accelerate the timeline on which some of those people would spend down, deplete assets, and then qualify for Medicaid, grow your caseload. So, I mean, you've got things here when you're dealing with Medicaid and the long-term care system. You have to take great care because you're impacting beyond just the individuals who rely on Medicaid. Now, as a system, and I apologize because I didn't come prepared with copies, but this is from a SPD budget document. What you'll see here is we actually had a lot more clients in the system on Medicaid back in 2001, 2002, 2003 than we have today. So we're serving fewer people because we redefined the poor and the vulnerable, and we reduced our survival priority levels and eliminated thousands and thousands of people from eligibility for Medicaid in Oregon. And so you saw those caseloads actually came down and today are lower than they were a number of years ago. So we've done a lot of things in the last economic downturn to try to, you know, to try to make the system as cheap as we could in terms of for Medicaid. You have to understand the vast majority of the dollars when we make a Medicaid cut that we lose, it's not the dollar in the state general fund that goes away. It's the $2 in the federal funds, you know, essentially that we're losing. And that's where that real impact is. And as Arthur talked about, the impact also beyond the services on employment for people. We've got a workforce in our membership alone of about 30,000 people, Oregonians who work in long-term care as caregivers and nurses and administrators and all kinds of ancillary service professionals. You talk specifically on your question about the assisted living market and what's happening on rates and everything else there. Well, I think what you're seeing is we're back to where we were a couple years ago, where I think folks are wanting to retrench and pull back from that, having Medicaid contracts again due to the uncertainty, due to the fact that if you have a high Medicaid caseload in your facility, you're actually having to charge above market rates to your private pay, residents because of the cost shifting, and it makes you less competitive than in the private pay market. And so you've got a lot of those things. In the nursing facility sector, what you're seeing increasingly is lengths of stay are getting very, very short. Medicare days in nursing facilities last year went up 6.2% in terms of what you're seeing under managed care and Medicare managed care is they substitute directly a skilled nursing day for a hospital day to transition people out of the hospital faster. You're seeing average lengths of stay on that short stay population anywhere from 26 to 31 days. They're getting folks rehabilitative services. They're getting them restored to higher functional levels. And then 65% of those people are being discharged back to their own home. Okay, and that's all on that Medicare stay. One of the concerns we've had around the money follows the person, diversion grants, and transition program is on that post-hospital stay where you've got a Medicare benefit of up to 100 days, those are people that really need to go in, get rehabilitative stays, get restored to higher functioning level, and be discharged back home. Whereas right now we're spending a lot of time and effort and resources actually trying to divert some of those people. And if you're talking to dual eligible and on day one they don't go in for a post-hospital skilled nursing stay and they're going out to a community placement, you're seeing where Medicaid becomes the primary payer day one on that circumstance. But also you're seeing a situation where we believe there's some evidence of higher rehospitalization rates and things where they're going back in and generating far higher costs to Medicare, not to Medicaid. And so we think there's some things that need to be looked at on that program, specifically around that post-hospital transitional care piece. And quite frankly, we don't have a lot of people in nursing facilities in Oregon who don't have some pretty high care needs. For the vast majority, over 95% of all admissions are coming direct from the hospital. For the long-stay residents, the ones who are not being transitioned back home or to another level of care, for for the most part, on those folks, those are folks who have some very, very high needs and complex medical needs. And so I think, as Rick indicated, as Arthur indicated, we've got a very good system. It's generally acknowledged across the country as probably one of the most cost-effective. But, you know, we're continuing to find ourselves in a situation where we're having to pull more and more resources out.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know I'm not a proponent for across-the-board cuts, because I don't think that it bodes us well, and it doesn't get us at the issue of value. But, you know, everyone has to take a hit. But having said that, and having, you know, knowing where we are, how engaged or involved are you with the agency in a collaborative way of talking about the total system? Because, you know, what I'm hearing, and Oregon has been very proud to talk about our long-term care system and the pieces that are put together, and what I'm hearing is there is the great possibility of the system that we care about so much, of that system being pulled apart. And so it's, I asked the question, whether we're dealing with seniors or we're dealing with children, how involved are the providers and those groups who actually are on the ground, who actually have the impact felt, involved with the agency or are in looking at where we can make reasonable some reductions, because we're going to have to make reductions. Mm-hmm. And where is the best place for us to look without totally destroying our system?
Yeah, I'd say, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I think, we have a very good and collaborative relationship, obviously, with the agency. I think specifically about what are we going to do on this situation between now and June 30 for the next budget. I don't think we've had probably the level of discussions we need to on where we're going and how we're going to get there between now and the end of the session, and really for the 11-13 biennium. I think also within the Department of Human Services, a tremendous amount of the attention and the energy and the resources at DHS has been focused on the creation of the Oregon Health Authority, and, you know, what's happening on healthcare reform and setting up exchanges and a lot of things that are very, very important. I'm not trying to diminish that work in any way, shape, or fashion, but I just think a lot of the energy and the resources and the time and attention of folks have been focused in that direction as opposed on to this program and service area.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, Rick Bennett again. I think Mr. Taves, if he were here, would also be mentioning that we are, to some extent, certainly handcuffed in how we respond to these budget issues, in fact, that there are requirements related to maintenance of effort that came along with enhanced federal funds that make it very difficult to make changes related to eligibility. You also have the mandate related to long-term care related to nursing facilities. So the department, and we've had a number of discussions with Mr. Taves and others related to the current budget and the difficulties we're facing, their options for reducing, you know, the expenditures of their division are rather limited, and I think that's why you see the recommendations that came forth related to the governor's request for recommendations when we made those allotment cuts on July 1. Not too many options for finding those or reducing those dollars, and that's still the case now, and will be when we look at this budget the next budget coming up.
Chair Morris, Senator Winters, I think the other thing, the other point to make that was touched on is that the allotment process and the across-the-board process is not a good process for finding creative solutions to budget crises. And so I have some hope that when the legislature reconvenes in February that there'll be more opportunities for a wider array of possible solutions, albeit painful ones, which we recognize are coming. The only other thing I was going to add is that one glimmer of hope that I have is that the incoming governor in his most recent document outlining his top priorities touched on in-home care as a penny-wise and pound-wise sort of approach to governance in terms of service delivery. And so I'm hopeful that he'll remain committed to this sort of approach.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. It's just my hope that the creative solutions will come forth, and you know, recognizing that that we're kind of all have to be in this together. It's not something where, and that's been a hallmark of Oregon, and I'd like to see that continue, because certainly there's a lot of brain power out there and knowledge power, and if we don't. If we don't do this together, similar to what we did back in 01, Jim, then I think we're going to actually do a disservice to the seniors in this state. So just needed to put that on.
It's interesting that the mandate of nursing home as the last stop. If people need nursing home care, we have to provide it, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to get any federal dollars. And that will take money away from education. It will take. That's a mandate we have to provide. So if people are forced into a nursing home, we must pay that top dollar of what? How much does it cost for $6,000 a month?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's actually kind of interesting. Out of, I think, the 09-11 biennium nursing facility budget total funds, it's roughly, I want to say, $681 million. Out of that, only $105 million is general fund, though. The rest of that program is supported with provider taxes, client contributions of about $94-95 million, yeah. Individuals contributing their cost care, and then the rest of it's federal match. And so you actually have less money in your nursing facility program this biennium than you had in the 99-01 biennium in terms of just dollar for dollar, on straight dollar for dollar. So we floated that boat primarily with provider tax and federal funds for a better part of a decade. So it's a hell of a
value. What's
it's
the
about
worst
15
case?
Cents on the dollar to the state.
Yeah. What's the worst case scenario?
I mean, I think the federal government requires under, if you're going to have a Medicaid program, you have to have at a minimum a nursing facility
right.
benefit. All right. And so that's something we can't, but you know, we don't have the ability as a state to change. We've built a good system with a lot of good home and community-based alternatives, and we've got the lowest nursing facility utilization rate in the country, bar none. And nursing facility care and services, you know, increasingly year after year after year is becoming short stay, transitional care, transitioning people from the hospital back home or to a lower level of care, or, you know, frankly, into nursing facility has posed as an alternative to an unnecessary hospitalization. So it's really not about nursing homes. People who are out receiving in-home services or assisted living and a lot of these other services don't require nursing facility level of care. If all of a sudden those other services go away, for the most part, people don't choose to enter a nursing facility unless they absolutely need that level of care. You don't choose to go to a hospital unless you need to be hospitalized.
Yeah. But the whole scenario, though, you know, we've been through this last year, and we did put extra money into the assisted living to keep them in business, and there are people who may decide not to, and we're going to be forced into the worst-case scenario.
Yeah.
And that means cuts in education, cuts in public safety, and so on. I mean, if we have to provide a nursing home care for people who need it, it's bleak.
Mr. Chair, you know, unfortunately, and it's not just Oregon, we're caught in a situation, an economic situation, and, you know, most of the stuff that we're talking about that are requirements, when we talk maintenance of effort, is federal, mandates are federal, and these are some of the issues if we want that match that we've got to actually to do. So, you know, you're talking about where. And that's why I don't like cross-the-board cuts, because it doesn't get you to where you can do the best utilization of dollars. And, you know, ultimately we're going to have to be where the highest and best return are, unfortunately, because of the climate that we're in. But having said that, and knowing those are the realities that we're having to deal with, I think it's prudent on our part to not only point out where those barriers and obstacles are, but also where there could be some possible solutions. And I think that that's the question that I'm asking you to work with the agencies and that kind of creativity, because certainly we're going to have to address it from the standpoint of not only the federal dollars, but what are we doing as a state that we can also, you know, do some maximization without doing across-the-board kinds of things?
Senator Shields had an interesting program three or four sessions ago, faith-based. The pilot project was in Coos Bay. It was that if a person came in for services to the state, that one of the questions they were asked is, do you have a church that you attend? Do you have a support group? And if you do, we would like to work with them. I don't know what happened to that program, but, you know, we that would be one way of dealing with it. Now, faith-based is not all bad. St. Vincent de Paul is faith-based, but there is that separation between what they're doing, you know, the church and state. So there are a lot of faith-based organizations, and maybe that's one of the areas that we have to really, really look at, is where are the organizations, the religious organizations, where do they fit in to this? That would be one of the areas. Other questions, comments?
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair, to your comment and my original question, in that, you know, it's a new world, and even in the nonprofit arena, 90% of my clients are nonprofits all over the country and the world, actually. It's a new day. You say they're struggling just as much. Some are, some aren't. But what they're doing is reengineering the issues that they're addressing and how they operate, too. So I just see this as an opportunity to not just discount them because they're struggling, too, with the reduction in donations and contributions. They, too, are trying to be creative and trying to reengineer what they do and re-look at their missions to see if, in fact, they're addressing the needs that need to be addressed. Like I say, I wouldn't give up on that being an alternative or a solution as far as a stakeholder to have a conversation and trying to find alternative solutions to these budget cuts that we're going to be facing.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I could, Mr. Chairman, Senator Telfer, first I would mention that, although the chairman called the three of us up here, it's rather unusual that industry and labor and organizations representing consumers work as well together as our organizations do and many other organizations and advocates who represent seniors and people with disabilities. It is really the exception rather than the rule. And secondly, I would say that because of that, our organizations certainly have significant resources related to knowledge of different demonstration projects and opportunities and so forth, and we in fact are working together to try to come up with some different proposals or options that we might all take a look at and see whether in fact not only will it help preserve a system that is proven to be effective and efficient, but will enhance that system to ensure that it will be sustainable over several years to come.
Right, Mr. Chair and Senator Telfer, if I might. Our members include a number of faith-based organizations, not-for-profit organizations, for-profit organizations, and others, and they all, I think, are doing a very excellent job of delivering high-quality care and services at the lowest cost they possibly can, and I think they do a superb job at it. You need to understand long-term care is really a people-to-people proposition. There's very limited opportunity to, automate some of these functions and the like. Labor and labor-related costs are the largest component of the services. Once you get beyond labor and labor-related costs, when you get into the 24/7 settings, you've got your property costs, you've got your mortgage to pay, and your physical plant. And really, once you get beyond those areas, you're into food, you're into supplies, you're into some pretty hard fixed costs. And folks run very efficient. They run very lean and mean in terms on their delivery systems there. I think if we're going to look at an area where we maybe do have potential for innovation and greater use of technology and some of that, I'd say it's in areas where looking at things like Medicaid eligibility determinations across the country, we're spending billions and billions of dollars on, you know, what I'd call 1970s technology, essentially on how we make a determination on if somebody's eligible or not for Medicaid. Okay, and so that's a core function that has to be performed in our system, okay, before somebody enters the system. And that's something where, from a private sector standpoint, I don't think a lot of private sector organizations would probably be doing the same kind of old-school eligibility determination process if the feds would partner with states and allow for things to be done online, other types of things like that. I think there's tremendous potential for savings and efficiencies that are very consumer-friendly, friendly to families and others, particularly when you consider family members and people involved oftentimes don't live in the same community, maybe has the individual. And so I think we've got to look at a lot of those kinds of issues on what we have out there. How are we administering the programs? How are we delivering those services? How are we making core functions like eligibility determinations? You can go back to SSI disability determinations prior to the 70s. Those were all made at local county government office determinations and like, and the feds actually kind of federalized that determination process in the early 70s and streamlined and actually shortened the time period in which those disability determinations were made by bringing some, at that point in time, more uniformity to the process and how those determinations were made. I think we got to start to look at some of those kinds of things in the system.
Okay. Senator Montesanto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we also have to realize that the senior population is increasing. The state of Oregon, it's our population growth is about 1%. The senior population, which is 65 and over, and I turned 65 this month, okay, we are growing at 3.6%. And out of that, we are looking at Alzheimer's and dementia. And more people, the fastest growing group is those staying alive after the age of 85. Mm-hmm. So we also have to be very involved with getting a strategic plan on how we are going to deal with public guardianships, with Alzheimer's and dementia, with behaviors of seniors who their behaviors change and are very, it's very hard for a family to manage. So, I mean, we're in a I think we are just the tip of the iceberg of what we have to deal with. This is extremely important population, and so thinking outside the box is extremely important.
So you will have the honor of dealing with this next session.
They combined your committee and my committee together and health care reform.
And you have a sub.
Yeah. Anyway, we have a good working group. We have a great support group that has been meeting for the last couple of sessions, and James Taves has been very much a part of this, and I think that we have a lot to build on. Kathy Cooper, could you come up again? Go ahead, Arthur.
I'll take the closing comment here for this group, and I do want to say that over the course of the last number of years, the legislature has done a great job, you know, keeping the system relatively intact, improving the quality of home care, improving nursing home safety, preserving client choice. And a lot of that work wouldn't have been done without your leadership, Senator.
Yeah.
And this is our last formal chance to visit in a formal setting with you. On behalf of our organizations, I want to say thank you for your leadership. Thank you for all you've done to champion seniors and vulnerable Oregonians. Yeah, you've done a great job, and you'll really be missed.
Here, here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I will really miss you, too. You took a big load, and your passion for so many issues, I'm going to miss you.
Thank you. So Senator Frank Shields, when he was here, instituted a program that I don't know where that is. Kathy, are you familiar with that? Do you have anything to add?
Senator Morissette, I was trying to bring my recollection back as you asked the question. I am aware that our local offices do a tremendous amount of work with faith-based organizations. One of the largest ones is the Interfaith Caregiver Group.
Oh.
And across the state, our staff work with faith-based groups all the time. So I can't recall if it was actually at the work of Senator Shields or if it was work that we had already been doing. But it is an area where we look for informal supports and for community-based activities.
Okay. I guess I would like, I'm hoping that it will be more formalized. I'm hoping that that would be part of the routine in dealing with local programs and to just have a, because I think that there's still some reluctance to the words faith-based. I mean, that scares people sometimes. But I think, though, that that is one of the solutions, partial solution to our problem, and a more formalized situation of, okay, making sure that's part of the interview when people come in, without being intrusive, but if they can volunteer information about where they might get help, that would be great.
Sounds good.
Good. Thank you.
Senator Morissette, I wanted to just conclude because I don't want to leave you with a wrong impression about the senior and people with disability budget. All of the management actions that we spoke about, all the reductions that we're still facing in March of this year, which will have, as you have heard from my colleagues, a tremendous impact on our clients, on our caregivers, and our society. SPD's budget remains of $10.5 million out of balance as we go into this e-board session this week. So I didn't want you to have a false impression that we were out of the woods. So,
well, we have an e-board member here who will take good care of you.
Thank you.
Goodness gracious. Thank
and
you.
So with that, Senator Morissette, I want to add my thanks to you from all of the seniors and people with disabilities in the state of Oregon. You have been a leader. You have been a champion for our causes. You have been the ear that has listened to so many of our clients, to our providers. You really have the passion, and we wish you the very best in your endeavors, and we appreciate you all you have done for us over the many years, and thank you for your service to Oregonians and to seniors and people with disabilities.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Now I have one request of Tom Burns. Would you open that curtain, please, Tom?
A button thing.
We need the button to open the curtain.
Sit down.
Sorry, Tom. One of the fond memories that I have of 1999, the first session that I served, is that the curtains were always, always open. Mm-hmm. And I used to, when I, my mind would wander sitting up here, I would look out the window and think, gee, that's really nice. But I know when we do have the PowerPoints and all that stuff, we can't do that. But
also the lighting... right. For the camera.
I know, that's okay though, because
so they may come.
Well, we need a little bit.
Even when the sun is actually shining, you know, you want them.
Okay. We're going to hear from the Board of Massage Therapists, Kathy Calise, and Kate Coffey. Would you come up, please? I am really excited. No, I didn't. I got through part of the 58-page document, but I thought that the summary that you gave us, I think you're on track. I have a couple of questions, but who would like to start?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I am Kate Coffey, Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists.
Okay.
In May of 2009, the committee requested that the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists provide a report regarding modalities and why, or why not, it's in the public's best interest for those modalities to be regulated by the board. Mm-hmm. This report is in response to your request. The packet of information contains the report, a massage therapy body of knowledge report, a demographics report, and the proposed revisions to Oregon Revised Statute 687. In December of 2009, the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists created a multidiscipline task force to respond to the concerns raised about the various massage practices. The task force had representatives from several of the different modes and representatives of our board. This task force requested that the Education Scope of Practice Committee review other states and how those modes are regulated in those other states. Of the 22 states they reviewed, 14 of those states had exemption for body workers. They focused on the four bordering states, and they found that Washington, they exempt the somatic education and training, but somatic practitioners can only attend one of the four approved schools. California has no exemption language at this time. Idaho is a non-regulated state, and Nevada exempts massage given by prostitutes. On May 15th, the Federation of State Massage Therapy Boards unveiled the Draft Massage Therapy Body of Knowledge. We refer to that as the MTBOC. And one of the primary authors, Joellen Selfton, who is the director of the Neuromechanics Research Laboratory, envisions these guidelines being utilized by all facets of the massage community. Educators could use the MTBOC to determine what current curricula and programs could use revision or development. Lawmakers and those working to establish licensure and legislation could use the document to help establish standards, scope of practice, and educational requirements. It is the intent of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists to utilize the MTBOC as a guideline in working with the different modalities to further define Oregon administrative rules and to establish scope of practice and educational requirements for the differing modes. The mission of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists is to protect the public through regulating the practice of massage by balancing the needs of the public and licensed massage therapists through development, implementation, and continued improvements in the areas of public safety, boundaries, and ethics that will reflect the high standards set within the massage therapy profession. Currently, there are approximately 6,900 massage therapists licensed by the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. 85% of these massage therapists self-reported that they practice Swedish massage and one or more of the 250 different modalities. The compliance section within the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists has a history of achieving compliance with those who practice Swedish massage, but also with those body workers who would fall into the other modes definition. In addition, the compliance section has also worked with members of the public who have been harmed by practitioners who practice unethical business practices.
Now, I'm looking at the handout that you gave and the 6,900 active. That's 85%. And how do you define a modality? What is a modality?
Senator Martin.
Swedish massage a modality?
Yes, Senator.
Okay, so 85% use that modality. What are the other... define a modality.
Well, Senator Morissette, just for the record, I'm Kathy Calais, and I'm the chair of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. I serve on the board as a public member, and I'm from Eugene.
Okay.
It's a form of practice, I guess you could say. There are lots of different practices or modalities. The schools teach Swedish massage as that being the base of all other practices or modalities. So most of the strokes associated with the profession are Swedish strokes. Does that make sense?
I guess the question that we've always been concerned with is, are the modalities that are really not massage, basically massage, related, but are a modality that you cover, and that we're going to get to that, I guess.
I had the same question because, you know, I go to the Caribbean every year, and I always get this wonderful massage. So, I mean, it's not only Swedish, but Reiki, and other. So, right. I guess when you ask the question of modality, what are you talking about? Beyond Swedish massage, and what do, if you're going to certify something, I would think it would become from the institution that teaches it, somehow. So I guess that's where I am. Who, how do you know that that particular massage parlor should be certified or not? I guess that's a weird question.
The modality that jumps out at us is the one that we've had the most problem with, and that is the reflexologist. The reflexologist, we're... the status of the reflexologist apparently was that they were outside the jurisdiction of the Board of the Massage Therapy, but they felt they were still being included, and there was that ongoing problem. And then there are some other, last session, there were several other modalities that came to us. In fact, one of them that just massaged the aura and didn't even touch your body. So is that a modality that you would regulate? I mean, I you don't have to answer that specifically, but the modality issue is the bottom line of what we're talking about.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Chris Monsinger. I'm the compliance manager for the Board of Massage Therapists. Mm-hmm. And just to clarify the issue, massage therapists who are licensed by our regulatory board they have different modalities by which they practice. Swedish massage just happens to be 85% of the mm-hmm. core therapy that they provide, but there are they could hypothetically have 7 or 10 different ones, from anything from a neonatal pregnancy massage to a breast massage to the re-K that we were talking about earlier, which is the movement of energy without the benefit of touch in a human body during the therapeutic session. Even though we talk in large numbers with 250 different modalities, many of them are not recognized widely by the profession and are sort of this fringe right on the edge of doing other unethical things, which is the main reason, as I understand it, that we want to sort of encompass those individuals and try to regulate some of that stuff that is not in the best interest of the general public and actually do violate public safety issues and ethical concerns as well.
Now, one of the bottom line questions that you raised as well is that if you cut a modality loose, then they're unregulated, and that may not be the best solution. So a solution that keeps them under some sort of an umbrella that is not an intrusive oversight program. I mean, that's where the difficulty is going to come in, and I don't think we're going to arrive at the final solution for a while. But the thing is, we have to identify it and we have to keep working on it. Every time we had a hearing on the massage therapist, we had controversy. In fact, that's when I stopped having hearings, and there were people out there wanting the Reiki people. I said, no. Let's wait until we have a better base of understanding before we start trying to solve the problem.
Senator Morissette, you are exactly right. The current definition in the statute and in Oregon administrative rules is a older type of definition, and that is why we want to go with many of the definitions that are in the MTBOC, mm-hmm. and it would require a statute change, and it would require a significant Oregon administrative rule change.
Good.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up, and so you want to update the statute to better define and update the rulemaking. And I would hope in doing so that we don't become so regulatory that we box ourselves in, and also that you have identified what those unethical problems and aspects are, because, you know, without that, I have a difficult time in knowing just specifically what you're talking about. You know, I hear things like unethical, and I'm saying, okay, what is unethical? I mean, what is the practice that you would be able to cite someone? And I would like to know those kinds of things, you know, particularly in something like this that's so esoteric as massage.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And my concern, too, is that we get too territorial about the specific modality that you represent, because as a public health nurse, I really feel we really know public health versus another nurse in ICU. So I agree that we just can't sort of put restrictions or barriers up for these other modalities that actually provide a good service to many people, or people wouldn't be using them.
Senator Anderson, Senator Morissette, I'd like to just address that as a public member of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. It is my feeling that 10 years ago, I didn't know what Reiki was versus what Swedish massage was. So as a public person, when I go for a massage, I go for a massage. I don't know what this person is doing. And so that is part of what we're exploring here, is that how are we going to protect the public, which is our mandate as the board? And if it means better public service announcements or educating the public as to what massage is and different modalities, then maybe that's something that we need to do. But right now, the public doesn't know what these different things are. They just call everything massage. So a part of that is we're looking at that also. And again, you know, is this modality, even if that person is not undressed on the table, a chair massage, people aren't undressed, and that's still a Swedish massage modality. Just because they're not undressed doesn't mean that if someone is not bent to do harm, they're not going to do harm to someone if they're bent to do that. So we just got to look at all of these different aspects, but bottom line is, how are we going to protect the public and against someone that may be out to do harm to that person?
Go ahead.
Chair,
I'm sorry. Senator Winters, you wanted to.
Yeah, because thank you, Mr. Chair, because you just raised a fundamental question in my mind. And that fundamental question, based on any board or what they're seeking, what's broke?
Broke?
Yeah, what's broken? So if you're going to deal with talking about, you know, you talked about public, and my mind is trying to say in the area of massage, in order to find a solution, I guess I need to know what is really fundamentally broken.
Okay, let me give a little history about where we have come with this. The big controversy started with the reflexologist, and Senator who represents that area had a concern about the way that they were being treated, and the reflexologist who worked with the feet felt that they did not have to abide by the rules and regulations and maybe even the fee structure and so on of the Board of Massage. Now, that was settled, we thought, but word got back that they were still unhappy because there was still some intrusive thing by the board. Now, then there was a backup of people who, the Reiki people, I don't know if they ever testified, but there were a number of people who came to us who said, we do not want to be under the board of the massage therapist because we're doing something different, so we don't want to be. And my feeling was, I don't want to hear any of more of, you know, concerning this controversy until we've had an opportunity for them to come with some recommendations. Now, there are a couple things for certain. One of them is we don't want to cut people loose so they're completely unregulated, I don't think. Secondly, then it's a gradation of oversight. I mean, what kind of oversight are you giving the different modalities? What kind of fee structures do you have for them? What kind of entry-level requirements and all of these other things? And so there's got to be some finer delineations, I think, among that group. Now, let me ask a question while I'm thinking about it. Where does Reiki fit in? Are they actually under your jurisdiction?
Senator Morissette, they're not. People who are licensed to provide different modalities may claim Reiki, but understanding that doesn't meet the definition as described by ORS to, you know, the touching, the rubbing, the stroking. It doesn't. It's an aura energy-based practice. So therefore, there's in true Reiki, there is no touching of the body. So it wouldn't fall within that definition. There are a lot of modalities, and one, and Senator Winters, one of the things that I wanted to address with respect to your question is it's not the intent of the board, understanding their vision and their goals, it's not the intent of the board to capture everybody who may be providing legitimate services, as Senator Anderson said. The intent is to get those individuals who are claiming to provide massage services when in reality they are not.
Okay.
They are actually doing legitimate harm, physical harm to individuals. As an example, there's one, our office recently, the compliance office recently began out doing public service announcements on Craigslist and a lot of the large internet advertising services, because that's where a lot of people go to look for services. We are so concerned about electromagnetic massage, where they run energy through your body, and they call it massage. And it also, not only is that part of it, but that's a fringe sexual activity that this particular person who is engaged in providing those services also does. But she advertises under massage. And not only does that dilute the very foundation of the profession, but it's a huge public safety issue for the members of the general public. So that's what I think that is the intent
okay.
of the board.
Yeah.
I hope I clarified that.
Senator Martin, thank you.
Yeah, I see the board holding an extremely valuable role, because I feel that there are modalities out there that if a complaint comes from a consumer, if they are not under you, they don't have a place to go. And so that's why, but then I don't want the rules and regs that you have to be so strict. I mean, there's a balance, but there needs to be a place where people, when all of a sudden they realize someone is giving them a treatment that actually harmed them after they go and visit someone else, they have to have a place to go so that you can...
Absolutely. Chair Morset, members of the committee, I guess the one... when I began to look at the draft that we had for the ORS, the new ORS, I understood that massage as a defined term within the profession was not totally encompassing. And that's where body work, because you have a lot of people who now have skirted regulation, regulatory effect and control by using that term, body work. So in other states, it's within that definition because they've already addressed this issue in a regulatory fashion with the legislature. And that's all we're trying to do, is to be able to those individuals who are skirting the massage regulations by using body work and other terms, just to capture that and say, that's fine, do whatever that you want to do, as long as you don't call it body work and you don't call it so your consumers understand what it is that they're actually receiving.
Chair Morset, Senator Moniz Anderson, one of the definitions that we looked at in revising Oregon Revised Statute 687 was to clearly delineate and define, take out massage, put in body work, but it is our intent utilizing the rulemaking process for the Oregon Administrative Rules to have differing types of education type requirements. It is our understanding that as they continue to work on this MTBOC document, that will assist in defining educational requirements, such as in the nursing profession, they have a certified nursing assistants, they have licensed practical nurses, they have registered nurses. It would be that the education would be commensurate with the type of license for the modality that they are seeking. Currently, what we have is one massage license, and I think that is where we end up not having consensus with the other modalities, is that we're requiring them to have all the educational requirements that we would require of a person who practices primarily Swedish-type massage.
Thank you. Senator Winters.
I just have a couple of questions. One, how many schools do we currently have in the state of Oregon that offer the massage services that are accredited? And two, how many annual complaints do you receive?
Second one, take.
Go ahead and take.
Senator Winters, Senator Morissette, there are 14 massage schools in the state of Oregon. Three of them are through community colleges, and the rest are private career schools. And I'll let Chris take the second part of your question.
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, we routinely receive probably in the neighborhood of 1,500 complaints a year. With those numbers are rapidly going up because of a lot of the issues that we're talking about right here, right now.
Can, can you provide this panel with a summary synopsis of those complaints and the specific areas in which they fall into so that we have,
Absolutely. We have that statistical information.
Are they from therapists? Are they from the consumer? Where are the genesis of the complaints and, you know, something? And then can you also, if you receive 1,500 complaints a year, what are the outcomes?
Certainly. We can certainly provide that statistical data for you, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Cindy Roberts, do you have anything to add? I'm disappointed that Mike Blackmore is not here. Is he your president?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the American Massage Therapy Association of Oregon. And actually, the directive that you gave to the OBMT last year originated from me. And the issue really is, do people who are not doing massage have to do the same schooling, have the same experience, and pay the same fee? That's what it came down to. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that, as the chair points out, that has been so difficult in this is that most people who are doing massage are doing several different kinds. The pinpoint that needs to happen is those folks who are only doing reflexology or those folks who are only doing polarity shouldn't have to do a licensed massage coursework, schooling, payment. That's the issue. If you're not touching them, you shouldn't have to go through the same process.
Exactly.
The compliance issue that comes up is how do you make sure that those people who say they're only doing reflexology or polarity, how do you make sure that they are, in fact, only doing those things? Which is why the regulation, the title regulation of those people still seems to be important, to make sure that they're not moving into that LMT piece. So the directive, because Senator Morissette, as he stated, was frustrated with the whole thing, was look at this and figure out who should be licensed as a massage therapist and who should be regulated as something else to make sure they don't move into that area, to make sure they're not hurting citizens of Oregon, but don't have to be fully licensed. It was simple. It was simple.
The directive was simple. The solution is not, though, right?
Well, Senator, I actually believe it is.
Well, that's why I wanted to hear from you, because I really appreciate the role that you've played, because you were kind of frustrated. But you're under contract to the board, and so you work for the board.
Actually, Senator, I don't.
I don't work
for the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy. They are the regulatory board. I work for the association that they regulate. My job is to protect my members. Their job is to protect the public.
Okay.
So there's a certain
noble
mind.
Okay.
But the fact is, and the legislation that they've put before you, I also had a hand in. But the fact is that whereas in that piece we're saying, okay, there are modes that shouldn't have to go for a practice act, they just need title, we took out energy modes and movement modes and said they should not have to do the same coursework, but we are going to watch them. My organization actually, and when that bill comes out, would probably tell me not to support it, because we as an organization think anyone who's touching the body should be in the Licensed Massage Therapy Act. And then the certain ones that do energy and movement, our national organization tells us shouldn't have any regulation, which may be fine for our association, but I, as a longtime 43-year citizen of Oregon, think there needs to be some regulation. So that piece of legislation that has practice and oversight is what I, as an Oregonian, would want to see.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
You said you're going to watch them, but how can you watch them if they are not
under a regulatory body?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis-Anderson, I think that the OBMT's compliance officer, through complaints, would be able to see, have they moved into the massage therapy world? Have they hurt someone? Has there been complaints about them? But by regulating their title, you know, it's interesting. We have Practice Act and we have Title Act.
Yeah.
Practice Act says nobody can do these certain things except for these people. A Title Act says nobody can call themselves something except for these people. So you would have a reflexologist. You cannot call yourself a reflexologist unless you have had this kind of coursework and you're licensed registered with the Board of Massage Therapy to provide that. So that's what the title piece is. It's a different kind of regulation, but it still allows the board to look at what's going on, take complaints from consumers, and make sure that people aren't crossing the line into the massage world, which is a Practice Act. As all of you know, Practice Act comes from Life Safety Welfare. You have to show Life Safety Welfare in order to get a Practice Act. So people say to me all the time, why are your massage therapists have a Practice Act? It goes way back historically to when there was health concerns as to those people who were saying they were massage therapists who were really up to no good. So that's when the Practice Act first occurred. But there are portions of modalities that do not need to be under that Practice Act.
What do you do with Reiki?
Mr. Chair, I don't even know what that is.
It's energy.
So it's an energy one. So all the energy, like polarity, all the energy pieces we nationally, our national organization says should not be covered under licensed massage therapy statute. Energy practices and movement practices.
So your association would feel that it can't be a subset. See, I'm into less government, believe it or not, and to build another board to take care of, I feel, a discipline that should be regulated, I'm trying to prevent that. It's sort of like having certified nursing assistants. They're under the nursing board. And that's sort of how I envision the energy modalities.
Chair Morissette, Senator Monis-Anderson, yeah. My association on the issue of license is black and white. Yes or no? What the OBMT is bringing to you has a gray area. And as you know, all things should have a gray area. And if we're going to truly protect, we don't build another board, but we put a little gray area into regulation that allows us to make sure that people who aren't quite up here in the act are still staying where they're supposed to be. I think it's a wise move to do it that way. My organization, though, says black and white. Yes or no?
Gotcha.
And I'm with you. They should.
Good.
Regulation.
As a budget person, because I always have to ask this, are you planning to come in to ask for an increase in your fees?
Senator Winters, on Thursday, there's a rulemaking hearing on an increase in our fees.
Yeah.
Okay. And the fees for new licensure for massage therapists is not being changed, but the renewal will be increased from $100 a biennium to $150 a biennium. I, as a member, as representing the members, will not be coming to testify against that change.
I would assume not in this economy. Mm-hmm. I ask that because all of this, when we talk rulemaking and we talk expansion and we talk about increasing the ability of the compliance officer and what have you, ultimately ends up with talking about more revenue. And so I think we need to be honest and open when we talk about these things. And so those individuals like myself who serve on budget, that's where my mind tends to go.
Chair Marcet, Senator Winters, I appreciate that about you because we can't ask for more without paying more, and our membership is concerned about dues increases. We'll be watching our board, but we will be supporting those additional fees to pay for what needs to be paid for.
I just got a call from a young lady in Eugene complaining about the fees.
Of course. That's what we do.
And ultimately, let's be very honest and practical. Ultimately, it's the consumer who pays it. Yeah. I mean, let's not forget the bottom line who ends up having to pay for any increases that we talk about in this body.
So. Amen.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, yes, sir. Come up.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I wanted to just expound just briefly. Mm-hmm. I throughout a number.
Now, give us your.
I'm sorry, I'm Chris Montanaro, the compliance manager of the Board of Massage. I'm sorry. I threw out a number that was just an estimate, and I wanted to be very clear that a lot of what the compliance office does not only deals with complaints generated by the public, the board has taken a very aggressive approach to pushing those individuals who are providing sexual services out of using massage as their mode, using the term massage as their mode to advertise. So understanding that we're trying to protect the public and we're also trying to protect the profession itself, a lot of, I'd say probably half of all the complaints that are generated through our office are unlicensed individuals who are practicing in the sexual services arena. So I just wanted to clarify that for you. I will get you the data as we discuss, but I want you to understand that that's a large part of what we do.
Okay. Thanks.
So you go out to the adult clubs?
only in Nevada.
And you would be surprised, Senator Moore said that's not just in Nevada.
No, it's not just in Nevada.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Telfer.
Question. What you just said, could you not address some of the problem here by an ethics rule? And I'm coming from this, coming to the question from, as a CPA, you know, our regulatory body is the Board of Accountancy, but we belong to the Oregon Society of CPAs, such as the difference there. We are not. There's a big difference between a CPA and accountant. Mm-hmm. Yes. And the Board of Accountancy does not regulate people out there who call themselves accountants. What is an accountant?
Correct.
What is an accountant?
Correct.
Some states only allow the term to be used for CPAs because anybody can push two buttons on QuickBooks or calling themselves an accountant. But we have an ethics rule. We have ethics rules. First of all, if you're not a CPA and you're saying you are, and somebody files a complaint, obviously there's punitive damages. So we get around the complaint.
Yes.
If you're not a CPA. If you're not a therapist and you're saying you're a therapist and somebody files a complaint, there's punitive damages.
I mean,
there's financial punishment, so to speak, to keep them from doing that.
Civil penalties, yes, ma'am.
Ethically, but we have ethics under the Board of Accountancy that really narrow what we can and can't do. And I'm just wondering if you can get around some of this issue with ethics of therapists, and if they're not a therapist and they're promoting themselves as being a therapist, then there's civil penalties. If they're still saying they're a therapist, then that's okay because they pay the fee and they do the education. But if the ethics, and they're veering off into a sexual avenue, there's where your ethics of the board play into regulating and bringing them into some sort of compliance.
Senator Morissette, Senator Telfer, absolutely. If you have the regulatory authority to take action to get someone, i.e. they are licensed, then yes, we have very extensive ethics rules that apply to licensed massage therapists. It's only when you're dealing with an individual who is not licensed, and that's where this whole problem starts, is, and why we're trying to capture some of these individuals who are out there practicing as massage therapists or body work people, and we have no regulatory function to be able to stop them from doing what they're doing.
Follow up. Well, then my question would be, then you've got the civil opportunities, because if somebody's out there saying they're a CPA and they're not, I mean, it's the same thing.
Sure. Absolutely.
You either are or you aren't. If you're hanging out a shingle that says you're a therapist and you're really not, then you have an avenue of addressing the problem. So I'm not really sure what we're doing here and what we're trying to regulate and what we're trying to fix. And I didn't get whatever your handout was, so I apologize. I was not able to get a little familiarized before the testimony, but again, I'm still in the dark as to what it is we're trying to fix, and is this really the best avenue to fix it?
Well, we will.
In fact, my question was going to be, if Idaho is not regulated, what is their history of complaints, et cetera? I mean, you know, they're totally not regulated. What is their problem there?
Okay. What the concern was is that we were being deluged by people who had concerns and complaints and this and that, and I said, enough.
Let's get a basis,
you know, so we know where we're, you know, let's set a floor so we know where we're going. And besides that, we have a bean counter in Springfield that's on his sign, bean counter. So what does that make him?
I haven't counted beans in years, so I don't know.
that's kind of like the aura, if you're a bean counter, you. Right? Okay.
Chair Morsett, Senator Telfer, what we're trying to get at is we have a very outdated Oregon revised statute and a very outdated Oregon administrative rules, and the definition currently does not fit to the way that the industry operates today. I don't think that 10 years ago you heard about polarity. Today, that is something that in this industry that is very much a topic of discussion. When you go and you look at all of the different types of massage or modalities, as we call them, there needs to be clarity, because right now it is not clear. To me, that's the issue.
That's what we're looking for, is clarity. Okay.
We're not there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, moving right along. Update on implementation of prescription drug monitoring program, Senate Bill 355. Tom Burns, would you come up, please?
Attachments to our staff. And all of the, Mr. Chair, all of the materials were sent out yesterday as attachments. And then
I apologize. I was not. I was in Portland all day.
Yeah. With the instructions for you folks to bring the copies, because there is a strong push for paperless materials.
Right.
See, pretty soon we'll get in
the chair, and some of us are chronologically advantaged to the point that our eyes just strictly go to paper and not computer screens.
That's right.
And just let me know.
Yeah.
If there's an impairment, we'll accommodate.
The issue would be
to get here. I have to travel the day before, so I don't always get these things. Yeah. So,
okay. But Mr. Chair, since we're on the topic. Pretty soon, I think we just need to bring our computers so that we can then just pull up the attachment.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to have to get in the habit of doing.
And that's a kibitz amongst yourselves.
Oh, yeah.
Right. We'll just have to be sure.
Yeah, it's not staff. It's
cost shift. Yeah, I just told her, really.
Okay. Tom, do you have anything to add to this discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have nothing to add to that discussion.
Too,
so. I am more than happy, however, to help shed a light
on
the
issue. Oh, the sun's going away, though.
But, yes, it's gone away, and if you look off to our west here, there's a great big black cloud heading this way. I have no idea whether it's aimed at me or something else. But, Mr. Chair, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. I have with me today Lisa Millay, the Manager for Injury Prevention Section at the Oregon Health Authority's Public Health Division. We're here today to talk about the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, which is a program that was passed last year by you, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 355. The goal of the program is designed to create a database that would allow practitioners to see what the prescription drug use is of their patients. So the plan is to have a patient and a doctor interchange. The doctor says, I'm getting ready to write your prescriptions, Tom. The doctor goes on the database and looks up Tom and discovers that Tom, this is now the fifth doctor Tom has seen in the last couple of weeks, and Tom has been to four or five different pharmacies, and maybe the doctor ought to have a conversation with me about why it is that I'm in asking for another prescription. The program is in its phase of negotiating contracts with a data processing company. The program has selected the Health Innovation Design System from a little city called Auburn, Alabama. I don't know why we ought to care about that city, but apparently they think they have a better football team, and they have convinced the program that they at least have a better
data processing system.
Okay.
So we've announced to the company that we intend to award them a contract, and now it comes down to sort of the arm twisting. What are you going to do for us in exchange for this? So to answer that question, the team went to Minnesota, which was the last place this company put it in, put a PDMP program in place, and came to the conclusion that we really need to monitor what we do. We need to get in writing. We need to be very clear what kind of program we want, what kind of services we want, what kind of security system we want, because oftentimes these programs are off-the-shelf programs, and they are simply, have we got a deal for you? Well, Lisa and her team are not accepting that deal. They are negotiating very hardly, and they expect to have a contract in place by around the first of the year that would then allow that program to start creating the data processing system.
Yes.
I just have to follow with the question, because it seems like now you're backtracking, and I thought that the agencies were actually doing their question that you raised first about what kind of all that due diligence on the data that you needed and wanted before actually having contact with the various companies. We deliberately on this legislative side brought in an individual because of the amount of dollars that are being expended in this whole area of data processing, whether it's off the shelf or whether it's planted maps. I'm kind of disappointed in hearing that part wasn't done first.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I apologize for the way I said that. When you go out for an RFP, you lay out all the what you want. And the company comes back and says, here, we can do all this, and this is the cost. It's now time to change we can do all this, and here's the cost, and put it into the form of a contract, a well-documented, laid-out contract that lays out exactly what they're going to do for us. They responded to the request. They have convinced the staff that they can do it. And now it's time, okay, you said you can do it. Are you willing to sign your name on this line? And that's where we are. I apologize if I confused you. The program is also funded by fees. It is fees against the licensees who might be using the program, anybody who is involved in the delivery of prescription drugs. It is completely fee-generated. There is no general fund money in the program, and the fees have been coming in as the licenses are renewed, and there is enough funds in the program to get them through the launch of the program, the starting of the system, and move forward with taking it live. The plans are to start with sort of an off-the-shelf version of the program. Now, it is subject to the negotiations that Lisa and her team are doing, but the desire of starting from that is there's a whole lot of bells and whistles out there that you could add to this program that would make it very complicated. Lots of neat things, but the goal and the timeline that you set in the bill to get this up and operating, the program wanted to start with basically an off-the-shelf system. See if it's stable. See if it works. See if the pharmacists can interact with it. See if the doctors can interact with it. See if the data comes in. And I said it and I'll say it again, make sure it is secure, because this is your and my personal health care data gathered together from centralized sources in one central location. They can also set out a master plan saying, okay, we'll go live here, but we know down the road we want to add this, and so we'll start at looking down the road and adding whatever other additions we want to do to it. We anticipate live no later than the 1st of May, and that's a couple months ahead of the schedule that you laid out. It could come earlier than that. When it does go live, pharmacists will begin once a week submitting to the system all of the prescriptions that they have filled. And then over time, that data will get bigger and bigger. And then, as I said, doctors and prescribers and pharmacists themselves will have the ability to double-check whether, in fact, Tom is out there doctor shopping, Tom is out there pharmacy shopping, Tom is out there doing something that Tom shouldn't be doing in trying to get prescriptions. A quality care program a company has been hired to double-check the work the staff is doing. It's Case and Associates. They have been meeting with staff. They've been looking at the plans that have laid out, and they will have a preliminary report to the staff by the first of the year. We don't anticipate any concerns, but again, because the process by which you go of buying a computer system, you want to have an outside person looking closely over the shoulders to make sure that we're not being sold a bill of goods.
Is that company from Oregon or is it another out-of-state?
You're not going to introduce
it. Case and Associates?
Out-of-state.
It's an out-of-state.
Do we have any companies in Oregon? Is everything that has to do with IT and off the shelf from out of state, pretty much?
Mr. Chairman.
I'm asking this,
yeah.
And I'm very serious because, you know, in looking at our own issue of jobs and being creative and needing to create a climate in Oregon for jobs, and with all this heavy IT work, I just really...
It has to do with HIPAA.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winter's point is well taken, and I think Lisa can answer who responded to the RFP and give you some sense of what's out there.
Thanks, Tom. Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, the pool of vendors out there that actually do this work nationwide is very small.
Lisa, would you give us your name, please?
Oh, for the record, my name is Lisa Miette, and I work
for
the Oregon Health Authority in the Public Health Division. So the pool of vendors is very small. And we constructed an RFP and a statement of work that was quite rigorous, and they had never seen anything like it before. So we really raised the bar on the vendor pool, and we got actually three vendors from out of state. They were all from out of state that could meet that bar. As far as the quality assurance contractors, those are bid on through a process that the state procurement office runs, and they have a list of vendors, and basically what happens is when a state agency goes to the state procurement office and says, well, we're ready for a QA contractor for this project, now there's a queue, and the next group on the queue gets to bid on the contract. So there's a process for doing that doesn't really look at where the vendor's from as far as QA contracting. I hope that answers your question.
It does answer my question.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to say that we're coming in under budget, we're coming in on time, and we'll have a system that I personally think will be a great help. And I want to just digress slightly and tell you about a conference that was put together on the 22nd of November, headed by the U.S. Assistant Attorney General. Our governor joined, our attorney general joined, identifying problems in the use of prescription drugs. There are more than 400 deaths each year from prescription drug overdoses. And that is almost five times the number of murders in this state. So it's a very serious problem. And the problem isn't the providers. The problem may not even be the patients. We don't know where the problem is. But what we do know is that by putting a system like this in place, that doctors will at least be able to know whether somebody is doctor shopping or pharmacy shopping, or whether a friend, you know, innocently, I'm in front of a doctor and I say, oh, I'm having some serious pains, and I fail to tell my doctor that I just saw another doctor last week for the same conversation. Those types of things can get caught. And hopefully, with this data, when we build it and it's large enough, we will be able to closely watch and monitor and make sure that patients are safe and that doctors are prescribing appropriately.
Okay. The next... program, or the next agenda item has to do with that conference. And is Lisa Millett here? Not Lisa Millett. I'm sorry, Jennifer Wagner. Excuse me, Lisa. I know you're here. Jennifer Wagner. Okay, Tom, tell us all about the conference that you went to that you just referred
sure,
to.
Sure, sure. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this was a conference put together by the U.S. Assistant Attorney General for Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
He invited in a fabulous panel of participants. There were more than 50 different people either sitting here or on a large dais talking about this. It was not to point any fingers. It was not to say that anybody was making any mistakes, but it was to begin to identify the fact that prescription drugs in this state are, in fact, killing people. When used appropriately, when used correctly, prescription drugs work. But when doctors make a mistake in not asking the patient about what kind of prescription drugs they're taking, when the patient isn't forthcoming with that, when the patient doesn't take all their pills and it stays in the medicine cabinet and somebody else takes that medicine, all of those things are problems that are going on out there. And while this program, the prescription drug monitoring program, will be a little step in helping this, because all it will do is allow the doctor or the pharmacist to see what kind of other prescriptions I have, that's all it's going to do. But it is at least starting down the path of trying to figure out what's going on out there in the world of prescription drugs so that we are not having 400 people die of prescription drugs.
Now, I was involved in the Pain Commission, and I remember voting on that bill, and Senator Dukes introduced that bill dealing with intractable pain, and I can remember the debate that we had on the floor of the House, and Representative Walker, Cheryl Walker, whose husband was a physician, took the position that no, you don't treat pain, you don't treat the symptoms, you go to the cause. My response was at that time that my wife is in intractable pain. It's an arthritic pain. It comes and goes. It can be anywhere in her body at any given time. We have had a long, long, long discussion on the Pain Commission about pain medication education. My personal physician does not believe in opioids, which is interesting. No, that's my wife's personal physician. And so, you know, you can only take so many Tylenol before your liver collapses. And so there's an ongoing concern with physicians who either give too much pain medication or not enough. And so the Pain Commission and Kathy Hahn, who was at that meeting, and it's an ongoing discussion that we're having. You know, how do you deal with pain for senior citizens who have arthritis where you can't fix the cause, you have to deal with the pain? And this conference is part of that discussion. And I know that there are some people from the state of Washington who were there who felt that we're giving too many opioids. Is that correct?
That is true. There were people from Washington who said that.
Yeah. And so it is something that I am personally concerned about. And I thought we've had a successful, you know, that the Pain Commission has worked well. Doctors are required to take pain medication seminars. Hours, and that's brand new for some physicians. So anyway, I think this is a really... Now, is there anything else?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think you've identified the problem. There should be nothing that should stand in the way of doctor-client conversation and treating the patient. But we also need to make sure that in that conversation is the full medical record of the patient.
Yeah.
And this program, the prescription drug monitoring program, will help. It is not a panacea. It is not going to solve the problem, but it will help. It will allow doctors to see what you have gotten from other doctors, mm-hmm. and whether you are doctor shopping looking for drugs.
Good. Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the pain management issue and the monitoring issue, to me, are two different issues. Mm-hmm. And you know, as pointed out by Tom, it allows us to see where individuals are shopping, and from that avenue can take some intervention. On pain management, and particularly with chronic diseases, I think you're going to see a variable based on whichever physician that happens to be your treating physician, as to how they believe that is the best therapy or therapeutic approach for the individual. So just...
Now, the reason we're dealing with both is because that was the next agenda item, and Jennifer is not here, so Tom kind of filled us in on that. So I think that takes... Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on those 400 deaths, do you know the age breakdown?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It is actually the 35 to 55 age where the majority of deaths are occurring.
30 to 55?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That's an excellent question. Do you know how many of those are recent phenomenon based on our high unemployment rate?
Don't know that. Lisa, your staff did the survey. Why don't you answer that?
I mean, when you say 35 to 55, you know, you're talking about an age group that, you know, for all practical purposes, probably family, individual, probably. So, you know, and I know that, that, you know, with the economy the way it is, with the stressors the way that they are, when we're talking about the level of high unemployment and what have you, that those are some things that lead to sometimes doing things that you wouldn't do otherwise. So, Lisa, do you have anything that would give us an insight?
Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, thanks for the question. It's a really good one. It's one that we've been looking at for about 3 years. We've evaluated data going back about 10 years, where you saw in 1999 some practice changes. And we've seen steadily over the 10 years a yearly annual increase in the number of unintentional poisonings that occur that are both hospitalized and people that die, largely driven by methadone overdoses. And so one of the questions that we're looking at is what particular types of drugs are driving these accidental overdoses, and what we could do with the practice community to help better educate them, and using prescription drug monitoring programs as sort of a tool to help both educate people as well as give them information about what they can do if they identify a patient that looks like they might be in trouble.
So it's methadone and not methamphetamine.
Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, for this particular problem, because we're just talking about prescription drug monitorings, since method, yeah,
right.
Isn't, yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I appreciate covering that transition into the other program, because I did want to have some comments on the committee that just heard. Now, the governor, the attorney general, were all supportive of that conference, and I know we did have people from the state of Washington, and it did, I understand, clarify some issues. So, good.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so...
Jennifer will be here in 10 minutes.
Who?
Jennifer will be here in 10
minutes. Well, we've already done that.
We've already done it.
We're
the
done with
the Pain Management Commission?
Yeah, we're through with that.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
So you can call her.
Call her and tell her to...
Stay home.
Okay, you can... Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to take a look. Go ahead. Where are we?
Sorry, you need to close your information on
oh,
the
okay.
work session.
Yeah, we'll close the information hearing, and we'll open a work session on possible committee bills.
Okay.
And we have one possible committee bill.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what you have before you, and again, this was sent in the email, but there was a little bit of a breakdown on getting copies to the right people, so that was just given to you in a hard copy. It's LC 2862. This is at the request of Senator Morissette. He just passed out an article, but Senator Morissette had a discussion early on about confidential material contained on copy machines that then, when used copy machines are sold, that private information is kept on the hard drive of those copy machines. So just as a placeholder, this bill was drafted so that we could have a relating to clause relating to the security of personal health care information. And like I said, being a placeholder bill, it was easy just to draft something that created a task force to look at the problem. But if indeed we end up getting a group of folks together to come up with a way to address the private information, particularly in the healthcare arenas, after we talk to hospitals, providers, see how they handle their copy machine information, we at least have a vehicle to put something into play if necessary. Does that reflect
yes.
that?
I first heard this on 60 Minutes on April 16th, 2010. Some of you may have heard that or may be aware of it. The report was that copy machines have a permanent hard drive that retains every single bit of information that is put on that copy machine. Now, think of anything that you take to Kinko's and have them run off. Kinko's gets rid of their coffee machine. It goes to warehouse. Somebody buys it. Somebody may decide to take a look at what's on that and would find everything that's ever been put on it, just like your computer hard drive. HIPAA, and the article that I distributed has to do with the HIPAA regulations. And when can just imagine the information on a hard drive from a doctor's office, from a, now I'm talking public copy machines, not private, but from a doctor's office, from an insurance company, they get rid of their copy machine. Somebody gets in, oh, look at all the information about all these people, all these social security numbers, all the stuff that they're taking. It's just mind-boggling. Now, there, on one of the articles that I was reading, I don't think it's this one, it mentions that the industry, that two of the companies have been warning people for a long time about that, particularly the public copiers. Now, I don't know what's being done in Oregon. And so I think it's something that we need to look at to protect the public. Now, this deals in this committee with medical information, and we're dealing with HIPAA laws and regulations. Now, the broader picture, the broader bill, and we may want to expand it to financial institutions, to penal institutions. You know, do we want the state pen to get rid of their copy machine and have all the information about the people who are there? The insurance companies, the banks, and so on. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. I haven't talked to any... I haven't talked to the manager of Kinko. I haven't contacted the copy machine companies. And there needs to be some work done on this. And I think, you know, just a public hearing would clarify a lot of information. And if we want to go to... task force, which would be a good idea, and draft a law, a bill of some kind. It could either be narrowly aimed at health-related issues, or it could be a broader bill itself. So that's what this placeholder is all about.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
It would be interesting at some point when the bill is dropped to have, I think the health authority is dealing with this issue from a medical standpoint, not, you know, other public ones. So it'll be very interesting to get their input on this.
Mr. Chair, it'd also be interesting to see how this, if federal law, Sarbanes-Oxley, actually does deal with this to some degree. I mean, it's mandatory that all entities now have to have policy on document retention and destruction, much of which is documents like paper, but it does deal with electronic documents too. But it would be interesting to see if any of that would fit this under Sarbanes-Oxley federal law. About.
If you want to find it on the Internet, I go to Google and I put CBS Nightly News printer hard drives. And then all of this stuff comes up, and there are a number of articles there that deal with this issue. But it just is amazing.
Well, I guess my point was more there may be statute, maybe federal law that says we have to manage it, and people just aren't putting two and two together.
It might be one of the better kept secrets because I didn't see that in any of the articles. So anyway. Yes.
Oh, what am I moving? Mr. Chair, I move LC 2862 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Telfer moves LC 2862 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there discussion to the motion? Is there opposition to the motion? No opposition. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Edwards?
Excused.
Senator Monica Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Telfer?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. So that will be a committee bill, and someone's going to have to monitor this as it gets here.
It'll be you. It'll be you. Will you give me a call to remind me?
Well, no, I'll be here. But anyway, I urge you to take a look at this. And I've mentioned it to a few people, and nobody is aware of anything having been done. Or it's just one of those mind-boggling things that has been under the radar screen. Now, this does not involve, the intent is not to involve private printers. And I don't know where you draw the line between a public, I think a doctor's office obviously would deal with the public. A private would be one that an individual uses in their home for their own personal use. So, okay. Where did our...
He'll be right back.
Okay. I have to wait for just a minute before we adjourn.
Dead time.
I do want to thank you, Senator Morissette. Mm-hmm. You've been fantastic to work with, and I personally am...
Well, we go back to 99 on this committee, don't we?
Well, I was elected in 2001.
Oh, well, were you part of the group that walked out of the Senator Cruz's committee in 2001? Too bad he's not here. We joke about that.
2003?
2001. There was a disagreement among the committee members, and half of the people got up and left.
Oh, that's when you were still House members.
Yeah, and I was a vice chair, so I went to look for him, and Senator Cruz said, "Are you leaving too?" And I said, "No, Jeff, I'm going to find out why they left. I'll be right back." Yeah.
Republicans
well,
and
one
Democrats
of the fond
left.
Memories.
Can we just stand at ease for a sec?
We're going to stand at ease for just a minute. Would you please come up?
And here's your lovely bride.
Yeah.
Up there with him.
Up here.
No, at the table.
Denise,
at the table.
I'll help.
Help her.
Yeah. No, she's fine. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, do you have your speech prepared, Janice?
Bill and Janice's last function.
You'll need to be at the...
Yeah, you need to be at the microphone,
James. Microphone, James.
I have one about the record.
Yes,
Janice. Well,
you must know that I didn't.
Why does nobody want to be here?
Okay. With the Legion of Arms, please make sure they sit down.
Are we supposed to sit on them?
Yes.
Since this is Bill and Janice's last function in the building, Sandy and I decided they needed a memento to remember us by. And this is a little gift for Janice. And
oh, my goodness. Thank you.
This is a little gift from all of you and me to the gentleman.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And we hope they come back and visit during session because we need their advice and help.
We will. Yeah.
Be sure to declare that with the Ethics Commission.
It was under $50.
My ethics watchdog is in the audience. Okay, well, thank you so much. Denise, did you have anything you wanted to?
You can open it.
Oh, okay, let's open the
From your committee, they'd like to know what they bought you.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure they would.
Getting in practice for open Christmas.
Yeah. I'll save the paper. Save the paper, please. Oh.
At Christmas time, I always say, save the paper.
Who wrapped these?
Oh, you know.
Our help. Yeah, I mean, put them on this committee for secrecy.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
That is nice.
What do you have, Bill?
I have a painting. Barbara?
Of the
watercolor and prints of the Capitol. That is wonderful.
When you miss us, you just have to look at that.
That's right. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
$18.99. It's in budget. I can't get it out.
Pass it down to Jackie.
Hagen.
Jackie can take it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. That's very nice. It's beautiful. I love it. Very, very nice.
Oh, love.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's snowing. Is it snowing, Janice?
Snowing.
I have some great pictures out of the window facing Willamette University and the snow. Yeah. It's really
beautiful.
And we are honored to have Judy Hall with us today.
It's beautiful. I really appreciate it.
Go ahead.
Where's that cake?
Why aren't you sitting up here?
Yeah.
Where are you going to go?
Okay. Anyway, thank you very much. It's been. I'm in the John Boehner mode, so I'm not going to say anything.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.